Getting closer and closer every day to what's going to be another spectacular iteration of a Chiefs AFC Championship game appearance. The second one in this 7-year stretch that will feature the opponent in the Buffalo Bills. Josh Allen and company coming to Kansas City to take on Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs at Arrowhead. So excited for this game, an opportunity for the Chiefs to do something that's never been done in the history of the National Football League. And yes, that's the three-peat, obviously, winning back-to-back-to-back Super Bowls. But if they win this game on Sunday and they get to the Super Bowl, that's never been done before in the history of the league, where a team won back-to-back Super Bowls and had a chance the following year to make it a three-peat. Of course, there has been a team that made 4 consecutive Super Bowls. However, they were not able to get over the hump and win any of those Super Bowls. That just happened to be the Chiefs' opponent coming up here on Sunday in the Buffalo Bills during that era of the early to mid-1990s. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan, here with you for the next 2 hours. Logan Weber here, my producer for tonight's show, is Julio Sanchez. I don't know why, Julio, I thought that we were going to be on from 6 to 9 tonight. I knew better. I knew that Danan had players only tonight, but I've been hosting the show on like Wednesday nights and Friday nights where it's from 6 to 9, so I inadvertently, in my own moronic way, decided that, okay, you know, I want to get a guest on tonight's show, getting us geared up for this Chiefs-Bills game. I'm going to get Jordan Foote from Sports Illustrated on with us, and I'm going to have him, you know, he's like, hey, does 7 o'clock work? I'm like, yeah, that's great. That'll be in the second hour of the show tonight. Nope, right at the start.
You're still new. It's all right. You know, the schedule's a little sporadic. It's okay. All's forgiven.
Yep. Sometimes you walk headlong right into a mistake, but I am still excited to have him on, despite the fact that it's the first segment of the show. We do have Jordan Foote from the Chiefs on Sports Illustrated on the line with us. My good friend Jordan, how you doing, bud?
I'm good, dude. I think that with me beginning the show, it's like the Drake song. You're starting at the bottom, and then by the end, you'll be there. So
I don't think that's the way.
For last to do all that, right?
I don't think that's the case. I think we're starting on a pretty high note, and it's somehow going to be up to me to keep us at that level for the next 2 hours of this program. But, of course, we got you on to talk about this AFC Championship game, Chiefs-Bills. Let's start with the insanity that is us as Chiefs fans witnessing this team get to a 7th consecutive AFC Championship game. It's the second longest streak in the history of the sport, behind only Brady's Patriots teams, who did it for 8 consecutive years from the late 2000s into the 2010s. You know, as somebody who grew up in this area, you grew up a Chiefs fan and around Chiefs Kingdom, what is it like for you to be able to cover this team now and see where this organization is in the realm of the NFL compared to what it was when we were kids and watching the Brody Croyles and the Tyler Thigpens and the Matt Castles and Damon Hewards line up behind center for the Chiefs?
It's the luckiest thing ever. Logan, it really is. And granted, I do the job, and I think a lot of us would still do the job even if the team wasn't so good, and people that, you know, cover the Royals right now are doing the same things and have been through the more recent down periods than the Chiefs have had. But for the franchise to seemingly, as like you said, when we were kids, the Chiefs are never going to win a Super Bowl. The Chiefs are never going to get this elite quarterback and, you know, the generational head coach, the future Hall of Famers at multiple positions, and for Travis Kelce's career to coincide with Patrick Mahomes, for Andy Reid's last, you know, 15 years, whatever it's going to be in the NFL, 10 years to coincide with Patrick Mahomes, for Patrick Mahomes to land in Kansas City and be able to sit behind Alex Smith, I think that was huge. Just having the collection of talent on the field, and then the caliber of people that they are, and then the leadership, and then the general manager and the owner, and just everything lining up nearly perfectly. And you mentioned Brady and the Patriots. Brady had that long gap where he didn't win a Super Bowl. And I think with what Patrick Mahomes has done so far, and it's much easier said than done to get back there and win another one. We've seen all-time talented quarterbacks like an Aaron Rodgers and Dan Marino, where they either get there and they never get back, or they win one, they never get another. It's hard to see Mahomes doing that, man. As long as Reed is there, as long as Brett Veach is putting the team together, this is, I think, a reasonable expectation every year, and it's going to hurt people when they have a quote-unquote down year and they lose in the wild card round or the divisional round, but every year this should be the bar, and it's insane that I say that, and it doesn't sound like a hot take. This is kind of what they have constructed and kind of raised that bar to almost unparalleled heights.
It's been absolutely unreal to watch this run. And on Sunday, we get the latest iteration of Josh Allen against Patrick Mahomes. It's interesting. There's a little graphic flying around social media right now showing the last 10 times these two teams have faced each other. They're 5-5. And each team has scored 251 points exactly. This matchup has been so even overall, but the postseason, that is where Mahomes has made his hay. 3-0 all time against Josh Allen when it comes playoff time. I know that there's every single year there's somebody or somebodies that the media tries to throw in the category of Patrick Mahomes. We've heard Josh Allen's name thrown around there a lot. We've heard Joe Burrow. We've heard Lamar Jackson, Jalen Hurts, right? Last year into this offseason, a lot of people were throwing CJ Stroud's name around. The rivalry, at least in my view, lies between 15 in red and 17 in blue. Do you think that that's the right way to go about it? Like, this is the rivalry in the NFL today. This is the version of Manning and Brady that we saw in last generation versus a Burrow or a Josh Allen or a Lamar Jackson?
1,000%. Like, I think this year, the Josh Allen that we have now, he's reached the Mahomes almost like football nirvana, where he's not committing the game-breaking mistakes. And in the past, it was always, okay, Josh Allen will give you a few throws a game or a few boneheaded plays where he's going to turn the ball over and that will be the difference. He hasn't been doing that this year. Buffalo as a team hasn't been doing that. And I think that it's always going to be in the back of people's head. But that was the difference between Mahomes and Allen. It's the championship DNA. It's the mental acuity. It's the ability to make that difference or not allow the other team to. This year, it hasn't been there. And that's with Patrick Mahomes having two ho-hum regular seasons for his, you know, standards. So when people say it's Joe Burrow, and I love Joe Burrow, it's not him. It's not Lamar. We saw last round that Lamar, although he's awesome, still has a little bit of ways to go before being put on that pedestal. It always comes back to Josh Allen. And I think that at his peak, there's only one player who can hit that Mahomes level where you can't do a single thing to stop him. He can put on the Superman cape. He can will you to wins. The difference is Mahomes does it a lot more consistently than any quarterback in the NFL. Allen has, I think, closed the gap at least a little bit this year. Anyone with a brain would still take number 15. That's not an indictment on Josh Allen, but he's one heck of a football player, and I don't think that I've talked about a game so much in one week with so many people. And the Chiefs have played in multiple Super Bowls over the past few years. They've won back-to-back ones. They've played great teams. People recognize how big of a matchup this is, and it starts with those two quarterbacks.
I like your use of the phrase Superman cape there a little bit, and I want to ask you, because I've talked about this over the last couple of weeks, that, you know, Mahomes has that innate ability to, like you said, put on the Superman cape, take over a game, as does Josh Allen. It just feels like with the makeup of these two rosters, Mahomes is called upon less to do that. Do you think that that is an advantage for Mahomes and the Chiefs coming up on Sunday with, you know, him having a reliable defense, solid special teams, and weapons all over that offense, whether it be at receiver, tight end, or in the backfield, versus Josh Allen, who, yes, he has some weapons, I believe, at his disposal, but there are questions along that defense and other places that he may not have to put on the Superman cape versus Josh Allen having to do that in order to win this game?
Yeah, I think so. And the irony of all of this is Buffalo is really well built in the trenches on both sides. They just had a game where Allen didn't even sniff 200 passing yards, didn't even throw for a touchdown. All of that can be true. The caveat, though, the Bills kind of remind me this year of what the Chiefs did when they traded Tyreek Hill, and quite obviously different steps to get there, but they lost a lot of high-caliber names. They shed some salary. They had this kind of retool on the fly, and everyone collectively, and I'd argue at the time it was justified, kind of made fun of him and said, okay, well, the Bills have this ascending quarterback who's right in the thick of his prime or just getting into it, and they're taking a step back willingly for 1 year. Allen kind of offset that, and the team lost the name power, but got some flexibility there, made some good moves. So you mentioned it, though. The weapons have not been great. Still, they have a lot of drops. Keon Coleman's up and down. The Amari Cooper trade has not paid all the way off. And then in the secondary, even at Matt Milano and linebacker, they're banged up. They have Taylor Rapp battling an injury. They have Christian Benford battling an injury. I think that Teron Johnson got downgraded in practice from Wednesday to Thursday. So it's going to be tough. I think that at their peak, the Chiefs can do a lot more to support Patrick Mahomes, but I'm not trying to, you know, slight what Buffalo has. But like you said, it seems like the Bills' recipe for winning, they don't have quite as many as the Chiefs might have on Sunday.
And talking about the injuries, right, guys that we may not see or maybe a little bit limited for this game on Sunday, there are a lot of players, you know, for some pretty notable players on both sides of the field for Kansas City and for Buffalo that didn't play in that Week 11 game. And so, you know, for Kansas City, you mentioned Isaiah Pacheco and Charles Aminihu didn't play in that game. For the Bills, you had guys like Matt Milano who did not play in that first go around. Who are, you know, one or two guys for either side or, you know, in this game in general that you see having the biggest impact in being able to help their team get a win this time around and get themselves a shot at another Super Bowl?
Milano's reputation is great. I mean, he's a terrific player. I do think that he deserves props and probably is the biggest difference maker for Buffalo. But it's the two guys that we haven't mentioned yet, which is a perfect fit for this little tidbit. It's one guy on each side of the ball. It's Hollywood Brown on offense. And I think if he connects on that deep pass with Mahomes and hangs on last week, we're having a little bit different conversation about framing his performance this Sunday. And then it's Jalen Watson, who was injured back in Week 7. Obviously, Chiefs Bills was Week 11. He was in the very early stages of his rehab. If he can play, he played about 60% of the snaps in the divisional round. If that goes up to, let's say, 75 or 80, I'm not expecting a full jump back to 100, but him being out there keeps Nazi Johnson off the field a little bit more, which was a very, very big sore spot for the Chiefs in Week 11. They can even play Trent McDuffie in the slot, which keeps Shamari Connor off the field more, which again was a sore spot in that Week 11 matchup. Watson is going to be the big X factor difference maker. And up front, you mentioned Omenihu. That's going to be a big deal. The Chiefs getting guys back, even Pacheco, despite him being sapped of a little bit of effectiveness, I think, upon his return, both teams being mostly healthy and if not 100%, still getting some guys back. Two different teams, they've matured since then, and man, I can't say enough about how excited I think everybody should be that we truly are getting the two best teams in the AFC squaring off with a trip to the Super Bowl on the line.
So with all of that in mind, Jordan, you know, it's a simple question. What do you make of this matchup overall? Is it going to be a third straight trip to a Super Bowl for Kansas City, or is Buffalo going to get back for the first time in 30 years?
This is about as close to a true coin flip as I can remember having calling a Chiefs game. Like I'm like 55-45 almost on my percentages here. It's going to be all the cliche stuff. Whoever has the ball last, whoever makes one fewer mistake, committing, you know, fewer mistakes on special teams, that's going to be a big thing. We saw Houston couldn't get out of their own way last week. We've seen the Bills last playoffs against the Chiefs. Tyler Bass didn't do too well. It's going to be third down. Andy Reid has been big on that. Steve Spagnuolo has been big on that. The Bills converted on 60% of their third downs in Week 11. They had a couple fourth down conversions. Like, it's going to come down to all the cliche things coaches talk about during the week when Andy Reid goes up there and says, yeah, the margins are really slim, and then you're playing, you know, the Jaguars and the low teams of the NFL. All of that is going to apply this weekend. So to put a bow on everything that we've talked back and forth, we've praised the Bills, we've, you know, kind of exploited a couple things the Chiefs might fall short on, but also praised the heck out of them. I'm calling 27-23. I think that it is going to be the Chiefs advancing. With that said, wouldn't be one bit surprised if Buffalo pulled off the quote-unquote upset. They're one heck of a team. They're mostly well-coached. Allen is great, but it's really, really hard, almost impossible, to bet against Patrick Mahomes, Andy Reid, playoff Travis Kelce, and all those guys.
I have to say I agree. You know, Jordan, I know that you love to talk Chiefs and you love to talk Royals. It's what you get paid to do, as we all do. But I know that you're also a big fan of the NBA and you're a big basketball guy. I am as well. So, you know, talk to us a little bit. Give us your rundown of the NBA as a whole right now. Right, we're approaching the All-Star break. They just announced the starters for the All-Star game here a little bit ago. You know, what's going on with Jimmy Butler. What do you make of the NBA season thus far?
Man, this is the most pleasant surprise I think I've had in a radio segment in a while. I am just amazed at out west what Oklahoma City has done with Chet being banged up and Hartenstein missing a bunch of time. They seem to be the favorite, I think, to come out of the conference. Maybe a team like Denver climbing up a little bit in the second half, Memphis being a sleeper. And then out east, Cleveland looks like a wagon, and that's with Mitchell having kind of a slight decline in his numbers because Garland's back playing well. The Twin Towers of Allen and Mobley have been fantastic. I think the West, it's pretty easy to see, much more competent than the East and much more competitive. But that could change if Jimmy Butler does end up getting what he wants and goes to Phoenix. Maybe you're getting the Suns having a second half, climb, but lots of fun this season so far. I think that a lot of people, even in the Kansas City market, or especially in the Kansas City market, we kind of have this collective thought of we'll start watching after the All-Star break, or we'll start watching March 1st or whatever it's going to be. But there's been plenty of drama in probably the most drama-filled league. I think the NFL has some pretty juicy storylines of its own. But, man, nobody does it like the NBA when it comes to theatrics and trade demands and just senseless drama. It's the best.
Oh, no question about it. And I would urge anybody, if you're not a huge NBA person, I get it. But if there's one person or one team that you got to tune in and watch, I know that they don't have a winning record. But Jordan, I'm curious to hear what you think. Victor Wembanyama is nuts. He's absolutely insane. I was watching that Pacers-Spurs game in Paris a couple of days, earlier this week, and I watched Victor Wembanyama in a two-minute stretch of basketball get two assists, he scored a bucket, and had four blocks in a span of about 95 seconds. I've never seen anything like it. Just absolutely took over a basketball game. He's blocking shots. He's rebounding off those block shots. He's dribbling 90 feet down the floor, kicking it out for threes, and scoring seemingly at will. I mean, he's 20 years old, and he's averaging 24-11 with four blocks a game. He's absolutely unreal.
It's insane, and I will be the first one to admit that I thought this would be probably his absolute peak. Like, coming into the draft, I was like, this Wemby guy is going to be really good, but they're giving him GOAT hype, and they're giving this prospect, and Chet can do a lot of the similar stuff. Like, I'm just not completely blown away by him. And then he started off a little bit slow last season, and I was being the dummy that I am, saying, hey, I told you, this guy's not going to be this top 10 all-time talent. It's going to be a little bit underwhelming, and everything he has done since then is prove people like me wrong that weren't the biggest fans of him. And now I'm at the point where all you can do is appreciate his talent. He can shoot off the dribble. He can catch and shoot. He can, play pick and roll on both sides. He can pass the ball. He's a generational defender. He has them in the play-in mix, I think, right now. San Antonio's kind of hanging around there about 500, which is better than I thought they would be this season. So he's a ton of fun to watch. The NBA is in a much better spot with him, and I don't know who's going to take the proverbial torch when LeBron is done, when Steph and KD and all those guys are done. But if it's not Jokic, if it's not, SGA or Luka or Giannis as an older player, it's going to be the guy playing in San Antonio.
Yeah, and again, that kind of coincides with what we're seeing, this change in the NBA with the international game kind of taking center stage, or international players taking center stage in the league nowadays. Jordan, appreciate it as always, my man. A little Chiefs talk, a little AFC championship preview, and some NBA to kind of satisfy both our needs. Have a good one, my man.
You too, dude. Thanks a lot.
No problem. That is Jordan Foote. He is the deputy editor of the Chiefs on Sports Illustrated. Got a lot more coming up here on After Hours. Our number is 913-586-7965. You can give us a call or send a message into our text line through that same number. I got an 816 number saying, "You're losing us, Logan." I know. Knew better than to talk a lot of NBA, but just a few minutes here or there can't kill anybody. I know Jordan's a big NBA fan, as am I, but we're not going to talk about it for the remainder of the show. I assure you, we've got a lot of football to get to. We've even got some baseball to get to. I understand the NFL fan base, the other 31 teams, slandering the good name of the Kansas City Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes. But why is MLB Network slandering Bobby Witt Jr.? We're going to talk about that when we come back. You're listening to After Hours with Logan Weber and Julio Sanchez here on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
Man, baseball Twitter is aflame right now. MLB Network is getting roasted into oblivion, and I'm here for it. I mean, absolutely ridiculous levels of non-ball knowing going on at MLB Network this week and in the last couple of weeks. So if you follow, you know, Major League Baseball and MLB Network, they do this thing every single year right before pitchers and catchers begin to report, right middle to late January that leads into February with the start of spring training, where they do like top 10 players at every position in Major League Baseball. And it started, you know, a couple of weeks ago, actually, with like with their center fielders and whatnot. And there has been some controversy along the way. Absolutely no question about it. You know, you look at the top 10 centers or center fielders. They had, you know, Julio Rodriguez of the Seattle Mariners at number one on that list. I don't have that big a problem with it, right? You got Jackson Merrill at second, two rookies, the best center fielders in baseball. Mike Trout is fifth on that list. I think a healthy Mike Trout is obviously still the best center fielder in baseball, but he can't stay healthy. So that kind of gets him relegated further down the list. Okay, I got no problem with that. Relief pitchers, you got Devin Williams of the Yankees, Cade Smith from Cleveland, Ryan Helsley of the Cardinals at three, Clase, with the Guardians at four. I thought Clase might have been higher. I mean, he was a Cy Young finalist in the America. I mean, like I felt like he maybe should have got some more consideration to be higher up on relief pitchers. But catcher is where things really started to devolve. I mean, Salvador Perez isn't even on the top 10. And okay. Ouch. I mean, if your argument is that he's not a primary catcher, he caught 91 games for the Royals last year behind the dish. So that is the majority of the year. He was still the Royals' primary catcher. Freddie Fermin came in and caught a little bit. Yeah, he played like 40 games at first base as well, and he did some DHing. But Salvi last year was still a primary catcher, and he won a Silver Slugger Award last year. I mean, we're not going to put him in the realm of top 10 catchers in the league when he hit 270 last year with 27 home runs on 104 ribbies. Okay, fine, whatever. If you want to make the argument that he's not a primary catcher anymore, so be it. Top 10 starting pitchers. Cole Reagan sitting at number 7. Okay, Chris Sale at 3. Tarik Skubal, 2. Zach Wheeler, number 1. What?
All right.
Really, we're gonna put Zach Wheeler above the guy that beat him out for the Cy Young Award in Chris Sale, okay? And we're gonna put a guy who finished second in the NL Cy Young race in front of the guy who won the AL Cy Young Award and had the lowest ERA among all starting pitchers in Major League Baseball last year. If you want to put him above Paul Skeens, fine, because Skeens was a rookie. He kind of came onto the scene a little bit late, right? Only, you know, 100 games or whatever he got a chance to pitch in the last 100 games of the year. So be it. Cole Reagan's at 7. Seth Lugo nowhere on the top 10. I'm not sure I understand that one either.
Can I ask here what's the criteria that we're working with here? What's the criteria, right? And who's actually, is this some kind of like fan voting, or is this who is putting these lists together?
It is a research team through MLB Network known only as quote unquote the Shredder.
And which, we don't know research-wise what this criteria is.
No idea.
Okay.
No, just the MLB Network's crackpot.
Take their word for
it. Yeah, their crackerjack research team, the Shredder. Okay. The only other thing I've ever heard the Shredder referred to as was as a villain for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Correct.
That's the only Shredder that I'm aware
Shredded
of.
This list. That's what we're going to do with these lists.
They definitely did. Third base, you had Jose Ramirez of Cleveland, Rafael Devers, Alex Bregman, Manny Machado, and Austin Riley. Okay, that's a solid top five. It devolves rapidly. And yesterday was the worst example of it. Bobby Witt Jr., according to MLB Network and their research team, the Shredder, Bobby Witt Jr. is the fourth best shortstop in baseball.
That's just ridiculous. That is just ridiculous.
What are we doing here?
Yeah.
What is going on? All right. If you want to, here's a little sneak peek. Right. If you go to Stathead Baseball, you go to Baseball Reference, and you can go side by side. Look at the numbers of the four guys atop the list. They have Gunnar Henderson number one. Corey Seager of the Texas Rangers at two, and then Francisco Lindor from the Mets sitting at number three, Bobby Witt Jr. at four. So just we'll go sort of statistic by statistic here. In terms of overall WAR, wins above replacement, Corey Seager at a 5.0, Francisco Lindor 6.9, Gunnar Henderson 9.1, Bobby Witt Jr. at a 9.4. So he had the highest WAR of any of the four guys on that list. He played in 161 games, which is more than the other three guys on that list. He had 709 plate appearances, which is the second most on the list behind only Gunnar Henderson. He had 211 hits, which in second is Gunnar Henderson with 177.
Not even close.
He had 34 more hits than Gunnar Henderson did. Gunnar Henderson's three places above him on this list. 32 home runs, which was third on the list. Gunnar Henderson hit 37. Lindor hit 33. Corey Seager hit 30. He had 109 ribbies, which was 17 more than Gunnar Henderson, who was second on this list. He had 31 stolen bases, two more than Francisco Lindor, who's second on the list. He hit 332, which is 51 points higher than Gunnar Henderson, who had the second best batting average of those four dudes at 281. 389 on base percentage, 25 points higher than Henderson. He had a 588 slugging percentage, which is 79 points higher than Gunnar Henderson. He had a 977 OPS, which is over 80 points better than Gunnar Henderson. And he had an OPS plus of 171 when Gunnar Henderson was second with 159. Oh, and that's not to mention the fact that he finished second for the AL MVP award, and he won the Silver Slugger at shortstop. Oh, and he won the Gold Glove at shortstop. So he's the best fielder of these four guys. He's got better hitting numbers than any of those other three guys. I just don't understand it. I cannot fathom it for the life of me how Lindor and Corey Seager are somehow ahead of Bobby Witt. If you want to make an argument for Gunnar Henderson, you're wrong, but I'll at least let you argue the point. But if you try to tell me that Corey Seager or Francisco Lindor are better shortstops than Bobby Witt Jr., you deserve to be institutionalized. I don't know who this research team is for the Shredder. My guess is that one of those guys that's a part of this research team had a Hall of Fame vote, and that was the person who didn't put Ichiro Suzuki on their ballot.
That's about right. I mean, that guy.
It's unbelievable how bad that poll is.
So we just don't pay attention to. I mean, that's really what it comes. They just don't want us to take it seriously at this point. Right. I mean,
yeah, they use the rankings are based on past performance, various offensive and defensive metrics.
So past performance meaning like.
Yeah, past performance definitely plays a role in Seager and Lindor because Seager was the best shortstop in baseball according to their list last year.
So we're just talking about career.
And Lindor was
talking
second.
About last year.
But if we're talking about career, how the hell is Salvador Perez not in the top 10
exactly.
for catchers?
Yeah.
I mean, the criteria makes absolutely
yeah,
no sense.
They're all over
sense.
The place with this.
I had to get on my soapbox about that because that was just absolutely ridiculous levels of tomfoolery and that's MLB Network. Like
yeah, MLB
that is,
should be ashamed of themselves for putting something like this out there.
You're supposed 100%. You are the source, right? Like you are the publication. That would be like NBA Network putting together a top 10 list of best NBA players of all time and leaving Jordan and LeBron off of it. Like it's just preposterous levels of lack of ball knowledge, I guess, is how I describe it. And yeah, we're biased because we're Kansas City people and we're Royals fans. But good Lord, are you telling me that Seager and Lindor had better years than Bobby Witt?
That's not being a homer. I mean, this is just common sense. This is just eyeball test. This is statistically speaking, it's just absurd.
It's absolutely preposterous. So had to get that through during the course of today's show because it's, I mean, that's mind-numbingly bad levels of baseball knowledge. But we're going to take a break here. This is After Hours here on 96.5 The Fan, talking about, you know, this list or whatnot. The Associated Press came out with their finalists for the NFL honors. So, Julio, I want us to get a chance to kind of go through these list by list, category by category, make our determinations off of that, maybe some surprise misses and other things like that, and overall determine who we think wins these awards. So that is coming up right after this on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
I gotta say, I appreciate that introduction from Furious George. George Karlaftis, fresh off a hat trick in the divisional round game against the Houston Texans, 3 sacks. It's mind-boggling to think that, like this week, right, reading the numbers on it, George Karlaftis, in his third year as a member of the Kansas City Chiefs, is now second all-time in postseason sacks with 7.5. And then Trent McDuffie, a part of that same draft class, right, also in his third year as a starter, is now number one in Chiefs postseason history in pass deflections.
I mean, that either speaks volumes for the organization's past in playoff history or where the organization is at now. I mean, look, they've had a lot of postseason runs here. I mean, been racking it up. So either way, I'll take it, you know?
No question about it. And hopefully they have many more postseason runs behind them. If these two continue along this trajectory, right, maybe they both pick up extensions this offseason and they stay in the Metro for the long haul, those guys could put together insurmountable levels of records for Chiefs postseason play. So, I mean, you talk about, like, the ability to evaluate talent. Brett Veach, Andy Reid, and the Chiefs organization have it. You know who doesn't have it? MLB Network doesn't. MLB Network does not have the ability to evaluate talent. And, you know, we're talking about Bobby Witt Jr. being put number 4 on MLB.com's list of the top 10 shortstops in Major League Baseball. They had Gunnar Henderson at 1, Corey Seager at 2, and Francisco Lindor at number 3. That is a blasphemous level of a list. And it's not like shortstop was the only poor spot of this list, right? No Salvador Perez on the top 10 catchers list. And then you look at their top 10 pitchers, Zach Wheeler at 1, Tariq Skubal at 2, and Chris Sale at 3. So I just thought, you know, for the sake of the argument, I would look at the numbers, right? Zach Wheeler had a great year in Philly. I don't want to denigrate what he did because he had a good year. He was 16-7, a 2.57 ERA. He struck out 224 batters on the year. That is a remarkable season. But he finished second for the NL Cy Young Award behind Chris Sale, who went 18-3. So he had more wins, less losses. He had a lower ERA at 2.38, which was the best in Major League Baseball last year, and he struck out 225 batters. 225 batters. He got the Triple Crown in the National League this year, but Zach Wheeler's somehow a better pitcher than he is. Okay, and if you want to throw out past success, Sale's dealt with some injury issues since about the 2019-2020 season, but prior to that, he was a perennial Cy Young candidate every single year. And then you look at what Tariq Skubal did with the Detroit Tigers. 18-4 with a major league best 6.3 wins above replacement. He had a 2.39 ERA, literally a 100th of a point lower than Chris Sale for the best in Major League Baseball. And he struck out a major league best 238 batters. His ERA plus was 170. His FIP was a 2.49. All of those were the best in the American League. So he got the pitching triple crown in the AL. Zach Wheeler is somehow a better pitcher than two guys who got triple crowns in the American League and National League last year. What are we doing?
Make it make sense.
I mean, what are we doing?
You can't.
It's absolutely insane to me. Like, what's next? Are we going to say Aaron Judge isn't the best right fielder in baseball? Is Juan Soto somehow not the best left fielder in baseball? Is that where we go from here? I can't fathom what we're doing. Ronald Acuna Jr. missed 150 games this year and still might somehow be number one on the list for best right fielder over Aaron Judge based on what MLB Network is doing with this list. But I don't want to keep going down this path. My blood's boiling. We got a lot more to get to. I mentioned during the last break that we're going to get to some NFL honors. They announced the finalists for key positions, Coach of the Year, Offensive and Defensive Rookies of the Year, and of course, the Most Valuable Player of the Year award in the NFL. We'll discuss that when we come back. You're listening to After Hours with Logan Weber and Julio Sanchez here on 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5, The Fan.
There's something not right about, especially this week of all weeks, agreeing with anything that a member of the Buffalo Bills has to say. But in a press conference earlier this week, Deion Dawkins said that the NFL should create some sort of like offensive lineman of the year award. And I have to say, I completely agree.
I like that.
Because
good guys need love too.
Yes. The offensive line is one of those positions. It's like the kicker or the punter, right? They don't get talked about unless they make a mistake. I mean, and that's unfair, I think, in a lot of respects. I feel like we as Chiefs fans do a very good job of, you know, pointing out and uplifting and showing our pride in our offensive line, especially that big three in the middle with Joe Tooney and what he's done since moving out to left tackle, which has been extraordinary, and Creed Humphrey, possibly the best center in football, and what Trey Smith has done in developing himself throughout his career and what he's got a chance to do this offseason, which has reset the guard market. But I think overall, in terms of like nationwide media, we don't always do a great job of pointing out what the big fellas up front do, right? I mean, defensive player of the year, you see defensive linemen be a part of that conversation. You've seen guys like Aaron Donald and TJ Watt and JJ Watt, and you know, we've seen Chris Jones be a part of it. That's an award that everybody can win, but an offensive lineman is never going to win offensive player of the year. So I think something like an offensive lineman of the year award would be a very welcome addition to the NFL honors, which the finalists announced today across the league. And, you know, there are some interesting ones. You've got the AP Most Valuable Player of the Year award, and we're not going to have time to get through all of this here before we hit the top of the hour, so we may end up bleeding over into hour number two. But let's just, you know, we'll leave the MVP award until a little bit later, right? Because that's sort of the coup de grace, yeah, so to speak. So we'll leave that one alone. Why don't we start with, like, Offensive and Defensive Rookie of the Year? And first thing I have to say, LSU produces. I mean, goodness, right?
Yes,
they may not win national championships all that often, but good Lord, they take guys from the college ranks and put them into positions to be successful in professional football. AP Offensive Rookie of the Year, Jaden Daniels out of LSU. Malik Nabers out of LSU. Brian Thomas Jr., also out of LSU. I mean, that's unreal. Unreal. And then you look across the league and you got Justin Jefferson and you got Ja'Marr Chase and you got Joe Burrow and the list goes on and on. They are pumping out offensive production pieces across this league right now.
That said, I think we all know who wins this award, right?
I mean, I would imagine
this is pretty straightforward.
A guy who took his team to a conference championship game. I think Jaden Daniels definitely wins the award.
Doing things that have never been done before.
No question.
That's pretty.
And then you got Bo Nix of the Denver Broncos, who I think for the most part gave Jaden Daniels a really good run for his money. Yeah. Now, I will say that a lot of these awards, or most of these awards, are regular season based in its entirety, right? Is Jaden Daniels run to an NFC championship game going to have any kind of factor? I don't think so, because I think a lot of these votes were put in weeks ago, probably even before the postseason started. But I think regardless, Jaden Daniels does win the award, although Bo Nix gave it a great run. you know, I don't think a tight end would ever win it. And if a tight end ever was going to win it, it would be Brock Bowers.
Correct.
And what he did for the Las Vegas Raiders, he was absolutely unbelievable. So he's another candidate for it. But I am in agreement with you. I think Jaden Daniels wins the award pretty well going away. Probably Bo Nix second. And then what happens 3, 4, 5, I think that's going to be a little bit more tightly contested. If do you put a lot of onus on Brock Bowers and the records that he set this year? You know, Malik Nabers missed a lot of time for the Giants this year and was playing with a revolving door of quarterbacks, whether it was Daniel Jones or you know, or Drew Locke there for a little bit, Tommy DeVito right at one point.
Hey.
Yeah. And then you've got Brian Thomas Jr., who played on a really bad Jaguars team, but balled out. When you looked at it during the preseason, it's like there's a lot of weapons on this Jacksonville team, right? You got Evan Ingram at tight end, you got Christian Kirk, and he was the best player on the floor on the field for Jacksonville offensively for a majority of the season. Then you've got the AP Defensive Rookie of the Year honors. And this is one that is kind of interesting. You've got a couple of DBs, you got a couple of linebackers, and then you got an edge rusher. So, and the linebackers pretty much edge rushers in and of themselves anyway. You've got Cooper DeJean, cornerback for the Philadelphia Eagles, and you've got Quinyon Mitchell, rookie out of Toledo, also a cornerback for the Philadelphia Eagles. And I think that shows you how much better the Eagles secondary got throughout the course of the year, because their front seven was always fairly strong, even despite losing Fletcher Cox to retirement. They had a good year, but it was getting that secondary in a position to be successful, and those two guys played a major part in it. You've got Braden Fiske from the Rams at D-end. You've got Jared Verse from the Rams. He's listed as a linebacker, but he's an edge-rushing D-end, right? He's a 3-4 edge rusher.
Yeah.
And then you've got Chop Robinson from the Miami Dolphins, rookie out of Penn State, who, again, out of 3-4 defense, he's listed as a linebacker, but he's an edge-rushing defensive end. I believe that Jared Verse will win this award.
Yeah, Jared Verse, man.
He's the only guy on the list that made the Pro Bowl, right? As a rookie to make the Pro Bowl, that's a pretty strong indicator of you having a legitimate chance to go out and win a postseason honor, especially if the other four guys didn't do it. My guess would be Verse finishes as the winner of this award.
Yep.
You might see Chop Robinson finish second, and then one of, I would say, Quinyon Mitchell probably third, and then Fiske and DeJean kind of finish fourth, fifth there.
Yeah. I might flip Quinyon and Cooper, but you know, I got to show love to the white, you know, cornerback there. You know?
Hey, I appreciate. I'm wearing my Iowa Hawkeye shirt today. I am an Iowa fan. I was a big Cooper DeJean guy, obviously. You know, coming out of Otebolt, Iowa. Population like 800 people, and to do what he did during his time at Iowa and then as a rookie in the NFL, that's pretty cool stuff. AP Comeback Player of the Year. There are some really interesting.
There's
some interesting conversations
some
to be
gray
had.
Areas with what we're considering as a comeback, right?
Right. You've got Joe Burrow with the Bengals, right? The injury that he dealt with last year, coming back this year, throwing for nearly 5,000 and over 40 touchdowns.
Yeah.
I think that Joe Burrow wins the award pretty much going away. Sam Darnold with the Vikings.
Should he, though?
Should Burrow win it? I don't know. I mean, he himself had a great individual statistical year.
He did, no doubt.
And, you know, he tried his best to lift a really bad defense and put them in a position to make the postseason, but he couldn't.
But when you're consistently hurt, does it count as comeback if you're consistently hurt?
He's eligible for the award every other year.
Right, exactly. So I don't. He's probably going to win it, but does he deserve it necessarily? In my opinion, probably not.
Good question. That's a good question. That's a debatable aspect of this, right? You got Sam Darnold with the Vikings. Now, never really dealt with an injury, but
he's been a journeyman.
Yeah, it looked like his career was over with, right? He's in a quarterback room there in Carolina that's like, okay, he's dead in the water, right? You got him and Baker Mayfield. Baker's playing like scout team DN. It looks like both of these guys, their careers are pretty much over, and they're just hanging on for dear life. And then he does what he does this year with Minnesota. J.K. Dobbins isn't a candidate for the award. I don't think he'll win it because he dealt with injury issues again this year and missed some time. Christian Gonzalez with the Patriots. Yes, he had a good year, but he was on a really bad football team. Damar Hamlin with the Buffalo Bills.
He had a sneaky good year.
He did.
And I think maybe the first half of the year, it wasn't quite as strong. But as the season went on, I mean, he really is probably the back end of that Bills defense. I mean, He's been locked down for, man.
Yeah, he, alongside guys like Taylor Rapp, he has been a very consistent piece on that Buffalo Bills team.
And the dude almost died on the field, you know?
Yeah.
That, if you're talking about someone coming back, I mean, just the fact that he's on the field playing deserves a nod.
There's nothing more severe to come back from than the fact that that man's heart stopped on the field. And anybody, any one of us, right? I know I remember it vividly watching that game live. It was one of the more terrifying things I've ever witnessed. I remember watching it with my then fiance and, you know, and coming, now my wife, and she, for like, that was one of those moments where she was terrified at the prospect of like our future children and will they be allowed to play football and all those sorts. That conversation becomes very, very serious when you see something like that happen.
Well,
terrifying.
That's Joe Burrow, you know, hurt his thumb. You know, DeMar Hamlin's heart stopped on the field. You know,
one of these things is not like the other.
Right.
A little bit. All right. Well, there's a lot more honors to get to that I want to run down the list of. You got AP Assistant Coach of the Year. You've got Coach of the Year. And of course, you've got the Offensive and Defensive Players of the Year and the MVP. So we'll be talking about that in hour number two here of this Thursday night edition of After Hours with Logan Weber and Julio Sanchez on 96.5 The Fan.
You're listening to After Hours, brought to you by Twin Peaks. Eats, drinks, scenic views on your home for Kansas City sports. 96.5, The Fan.